I tell legal lies. I tell legal lies. Lies, lies, legal lies. I tell legal lies.
And legal lies.
And legal lies.
Back on.
And
ban on drugs.
Ban on drugs.
And legal lies.
Welcome back to another episode of Black Law and
Legal Lies,
where we specialize in
the legal lies.
My name is Dan, and I am one of your hosts. You can find me on Twitter and IG at I Am Dan on Drugs. You can also find the show across the board at Black Law Podcast. And you are?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just Dan. And you can follow me at I Tell Legal Lies on Twitter.
And I am Afro Becky.
Afro Becky. Yep. We have a new segment for you.
Wait, what? Huh?
Oh, Lord.
Now, I would like for the people at home to join along, too. I'm going to need you to finish the following lyrics.
Oh, God. I'm going to lose.
If you want beef, then bring the ruckus.
I can't finish that.
Straight from the motherfuckers out here bussing.
Okay.
There's no place to hide as I step inside the room. Dr. Doom, prepare for the boom. Bam. Oh, man. I jam, slam, and swing like Tarzan.
No, you need to be about 15 people.
I be tossing and flossing. My style is awesome. I'm causing more family feuds than Richard Dawson. And the survey said you're dead. Fatal flying, something guillotine chop off your fucking head. Mr. Who is that? Hey, yo, the woo is back making niggas go buck, buck like I'm Super Cat.
Like I said, you need to be about 15 people.
If you want beef, then bring the ruckus.
He just said it. The woo is back. The woo is back.
So I'm supposed to say the woo is back?
Jesus Christ. You got one strike against you. The phrase. So if you want beef, then bring the ruckus. The woo is back.
Wait, so I'm supposed to say the woo is back? Right.
Jesus Christ.
Right.
Jesus Christ, man. Anne, would you care to finish the lyric? If you want beef, then bring the ruckus.
No, I want to say who it is.
Okay, we'll give you a hint.
The woo is back. that girl.
The RZA, the Jizza.
Method
Man, you got Raekwon the Chef, ODB.
You mean the Wu-Tang Clan?
The yes, Face Killer.
Ooh, thank you. Thank you.
So if you want beef, then bring the ruckus.
You said that too. You said Wu-Tang, nothing to...
Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with.
You said that. He said that.
I don't think I did.
No.
I thought you did. No.
Man.
You crazy.
Okay. One more. This is just for the people's entertainment.
I thought it was one per show.
This is a segment, man. I don't,
oh, it's a whole segment.
I don't make the rules. I just think them up, you know? So, Okay. I'll give you a gimme.
No, you won't, because I'm not going to get it.
I'll give you a gimme. Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis. When I was dead broke, man, I couldn't picture this. Okay.
People.
Today. That was the Notorious B.I.G.
Yes, it was.
All right. Now, on to the more serious stuff here. Ladies and gentlemen, we apologize for Afro Becky's hip-hop knowledge or lack thereof, but now it is time for Dan's Monologue, motherfucker.
You know what? You sound real angry, Beck.
We talked a few weeks ago about people of color ignoring jury duty, and I spoke last month on the Awakened Soul podcast, shout out to our brother CEO Hayes, about people of color who are eligible to vote, not showing up to the polls. These things made me realize that there's a real lack of diversity almost everywhere. Everywhere where we can enact change. For instance, Black doctors, they're in a real minority. Having more doctors that look like us and relate to us culturally, they would have the ability to connect with us more so than white, culturally clueless doctors. I think we'd be more receptive to medical treatment if that were the case, especially in the mental health field. Black police officers, again, they're in the minority, but not only are they in the minority, they're bound to a set of unwritten rules dictated by their white superiors. I've heard numerous accounts of black police officers being unable to exercise discretion in their own communities. They often feel powerless, even in positions of power, when it comes to their white counterparts committing atrocities in our communities. Think of unarmed black men being shot. They stay silent and on the wrong side of the blue wall in fear of disciplinary action or worse, termination, being blackballed, what have you. So if we had more black and brown police officers, I don't think that this would be the case 100% of the time. A real lack of diversity across the board prevents positive change from happening quickly. When we look at doctors, we see mostly old white men. When we look at government, senators, Congress, etc., we see mainly white men. When we look at prosecutors, judges, and lawyers, again, prominently white men. White men have been affecting our lives both directly and indirectly since we arrived here on U.S. soil 400 plus years ago. Today, I wanted to have a conversation about the shortage of black lawyers and how it affects our justice system as a whole. According to the American Bar Association, 88% of lawyers are white. 4.8% of lawyers are black. Some places like the now infamous Ferguson, Missouri, do not have any black lawyers. Zero. There are 61,000 black lawyers compared to 1,117,000 white lawyers. Let that sink in for a minute. 61,000 black lawyers to 1,117,000 white lawyers. If that doesn't scare you, it should. It scares me.
And it should. And I mean, as we've seen, history has taught us that we should be afraid of the system. I mean, we've had multiple shows that seem to bleed into this conversation quite often. And as you said in your fucked up monologue, that systematically we are underrepresented, but that is by design.
Well, I think one of the things that we can start the topic off with is, why are there so few black lawyers and attorneys? And my theory is, yes, it is systematic, based on environment, based on income, based on opportunity. So if there are fewer people able to access education in order to get their credentials to be an attorney, they also don't have the money to put them through school, which is what, 6 years?
Well, it's 4 years of college, 3 years, 3 years of law school.
So plus all that, not getting paid.
Right. If you want to get a master's in law, that's another year, year and a half.
The hell you need a master's for?
If you want a specialization. So like if you want to specialize in taxation.
Right.
If you want to specialize in family law, if you want to do
more also, money, more money, more money.
There are no role models for young minorities to. And I mean, there are.
Johnny Cochran.
However.
Right. But that's not what we see.
Yeah. And you don't see that very often.
That was going to be my point. That when young African-American, Hispanic people of color, when they see people rising above and getting out of the hood, they see athletes.
Entertainers.
You know, right. Movie stars, singers, athletes. So in their head, the way that I get ahead is by being a basketball player, football player, mm-hmm. a singer, some sort of entertainer. I can be an actor, because that's what we see. We don't see lawyers and doctors balling out of control. You know, that's not what's portrayed in the black community.
And then when they do get their name in the news, it's a Clarence Thomas situation.
Right.
It's the doctor that killed
Michael Jackson.
Oh, right. You know. Dr. Conrad Murray.
Yeah, Conrad Murray situation. Right. You know, we only get recognized for the negative.
The negative. That's correct.
And I tell you one thing, though. as much as I hate to say this, and we'll get into this later in the show, is sometimes you look at black attorneys as their jokes.
Right.
And
as less than.
One in particular, Benjamin, what's his name? Benjamin Crump, I think his name is.
Oh, the guy who.
He represented Trayvon Martin's family. He's representing the.
The new one.
It's not Botham, is it? Botham Jr.?
No. What's the it, this recently happened.
Yeah, again.
Right. What's the young man's name?
Shit. That's a damn shame.
It's a shame that we can't remember, right?
But yeah, representing the most recent shooting. The dude in Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama, who was at the mall when the military.
No, I think, and did he also not represent the guy in California who was shot in
Stephon Clark?
I thought.
I don't know. I do believe he is representing the family of the guy who was killed in Birmingham, the military. He was a soldier, and he had his weapon drawn because shots were fired at the mall. Police ran up in there, shot first, asked questions later. Turns out they got the wrong person.
Right.
So, and that also goes to the whole NRA thing, too, talking about. And I'm sure everyone's heard this on the news. Yeah, a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun.
Mm-hmm.
The good guy with a gun got gunned down. So
you just can't be a good guy with a gun. And
well,
black.
You can't be. Right. I was about to say you can't be a good black man with a gun.
Yeah. So that's basically, man, it's fucked up. But I mean, he's looked at as a joke, and not saying he's not competent, but. It's like the Al Sharptons. Every time something, for the longest, and I even believe this too, back, you know, maybe in the early 2000s, that Al Sharpton's an opportunist. Wherever there's somewhere he can get his face in the media, he's going to do it. I didn't know of all the things that Al Sharpton did when the cameras were off. So now I view Al Sharpton a little differently. But back then, it's like, man, this nigga always in the news, man. Wherever there's a problem, he running down there and getting his face in the news and talk.
Same thing with Jesse Jackson.
Jesse Jackson, mm-hmm. Yeah, all of them. And that's about how some of these black attorneys are looked at. It's like, man, he just represented Trayvon Martin, one of these big national, national media coverage spectacle thing. And now he's doing this, and now he's doing this. Man, he just trying to get his face in the media. And it's hard not to think like that, but when there's so few black attorneys, you are going to see the same ones over and over.
Especially if it's someone who has a reputation in a certain area.
Right.
Like a Ben Crump or a Johnny Cochran.
Man, I fucks with Johnny, man.
You know, or a Johnny Cochran. You see them winning. Wouldn't you want to go to the winner?
Mm-hmm.
So you are going to see them over and over again.
Right.
Yeah. So
I mean, the only other, I guess, role models that are seen are actors portraying people such as Annalise Keating or, you know.
That's actually, you know, that's a good thing to bring up. Claire Huxtable.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
She was like the first black lawyer I knew. Claire Huxtable, and who would have known that her husband
raped women.
I guess you would have to be a fucking attorney.
Yeah,
like, shit, man. So anyway, how does having so few, we're just going to focus on attorneys at the moment. How does having so few black attorneys affect us, law abiding or otherwise, as black people?
Well, I mean, this harkens back to things that we've discussed before. I mean, you think about it, because we don't have a large number of people to turn to, just like we talked about in a jury duty episode, we're supposed to be tried by a jury of our peers. There are not a lot of black people in the jury pool. So more often than not,
there's not a lot of black people in any pool.
Shut up. So, you know, you think that I don't really get a fair shake because I don't have people who look like me, who think like me, who
can relate to
have gone right, gone through similar experiences
or have a similar background to you.
Right. So, how can you understand my struggle? How can you understand you know, I might be more lenient to Jimmy from the hood because I came from the hood. So I know, you know, yeah, what Jimmy did was wrong, but
this is why, like, let's look at selling drugs. This is why, because he's from this area, poverty, high crime, high unemployment rate, low instances of fathers being in the home, positive male role models.
Right.
So your male role models are the drug dealers, are the gang members, etc. So, yeah, you can definitely identify as a juror. Now we're talking selling drugs. I'm a person of color. I'm sitting on this jury and they're trying to give a little 18, 19 year old boy 3 to 5 mm-hmm. for selling crack.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting on the jury like, nah, bruh, nah. Right. I understand what he did was wrong. And sure, I think 3 to 5 years is excessive. So right. How about let's start with probation, maybe?
Some sort of diversionary program. Yeah. Right. When here is Johnny, whose dad is a lawyer, whose grandfather is a judge. He was found with a pound of coke and, oh, it's okay.
Community service.
Yes. He just go pick up paper on the side of the road. So more often than not, and then when you talk about just that same thing, networking, as far as black attorneys are concerned, you know, that good old boy network
mm-hmm.
is truly a good old boy's network when it comes to the legal profession. A lot of the times, who you know, who you play golf with, you know, who you go out to dinner and tea with, that affects your turnout in the courtroom. Because believe it or not, lawyers are people too. They have lives outside of the courtroom. And I believe I've said this before, the law is the law, but how you interpret it, you know, the view that you have of the law is shaped by who you are. So I am more inclined to be lenient with a lawyer that I know, right? I'm more inclined to be lenient with someone that I've engaged with beforehand than I am with someone hot off the presses, fresh out the street, who doesn't look like me, talk like me, sound like me. You know, same thing. I can't identify with you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when it comes to an attorney that I want to represent me, I don't think someone who can't relate to me can fight for me as passionately as someone who would.
And that's exactly right.
Well,
That's true.
That's a double-edged sword, though.
It could be.
And we're going to get into that, too, a little deeper into the show. But, yeah, someone who looks like you representing you, they could fight tooth and nail for you, right? But also, I can see the flip side of that is having someone that looks like you in a courtroom full of white men, like we said.
And that's exactly what I just said, what I was talking about.
Yes, that's a double-edged sword. So we're going to get into that, though. So, Anne, do you have any personal experiences where the lack of diversity in your profession directly affected you, your clients, or somebody you know?
Yeah, I actually had a situation when I was in law school. I had put in an application for an internship, and it was with a fairly known law firm in the city, and they had narrowed the pool to myself and two other people. I was the only black person left, and I didn't get it. And at the time, I thought nothing of it, but later on found out because this chick that was in law school with me, she knew how to play the game. When I got to law school, not that I was standoffish, but for me, it was about getting in, learning what I had to learn. You know, I conversed with people, but it wasn't like college where I was running around hanging out with people. I wasn't doing that. But she actually played the game. So when she got in, she started talking to people, Caucasian people, you know, and she got in good with a lot of the Caucasian people. And like I said, later I found out through her that the person who actually got the internship, his dad, who was a lawyer, was friends with somebody on the selection committee at the firm. So
So it was the old New Orleans, who you know type of situation.
Right. It's not what you know, it's who you know.
Okay. So being that it's who you know, how did the lack of diversity contribute to that? Not just nepotism or whatever.
Well, it's not particularly nepotism. It's the fact that, hearkening back to what we said earlier, there are 1 million+ white lawyers in the United States. 61,000 black. The firm that we were all up for an internship, majority Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you would think that they would have wanted a little diversity, but I guess they had met their quota, you know. So it wasn't just nepotism in my head. Like, after the fact, it wasn't just that, oh, I'm doing, you know, the person on the selection committee did a favor for a friend. For me, it wasn't just about that. It was about the fact that I was a black woman and it was two white men that I was up against. So It's like, when
you're going to lose that every time.
Right. And that's what I was about to say. When there's a choice between John, James, and Janika, John or James go win every time.
Yeah. Well, with that being said, we do know, as far as going back to how it affects us, we do know that black people make up roughly 12% of the entire adult population in the United States. But we make up 33% of the prison population.
Mm-hmm.
Latinos make up 16%. They surpassed us. That kind of surprised me. Of the adult population, they make up 23% of the total prison population. So together, black and Latinos make up over 50% of the prison population. And we previously discussed that in a few episodes. Mm-hmm. But would you, being that we make up 28%, we make up 28% total of adults in America, and we make up 56% of the prison population. Would you attribute that to lack of diversity in, again, the legal profession?
Absolutely. I mean, what I said about 5-ish minutes ago, if you had more judges that looked like us, if you had more lawyers that looked like us, more people on the juries that looked like us, do you think that these people would be in jail for minor infractions? You know, it's not like I'm gonna send a brother to jail just because. I would be more prone to understand where they came from and try to help them rather than penalize them. But because there are more Caucasian people in the legal system, the system is skewed towards imprisoning people of color. I mean, that is a fact that's been borne out in numerous studies. All the statistics show that. I mean, the times that we've spoken about it and we've thrown out these numbers, you can see how many black people go to diversionary programs. Look how President Obama had to change those sentencing guidelines in order to get people out of jail who, you know, we talk about crack cocaine versus powder. You know, here it is. The brother had 2 crack rocks and got 20 years. And dude, like I said, dude had a brick of cocaine and you picking up paper on the side of the road because you got community service.
What's crazy about that, though, is gram for gram, right? You got a gram of crack and a gram of coke.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who has more cocaine? You're getting harsher sentences for less of the same substance.
Right. So, and that is basically a function of, we know that crack was something that was introduced heavily into the black community. And most people that were going to jail for crack were what? Right. So
war against black people.
Right. Yeah. So if we had, once again, people who understood, who could look at you and go, yep, I understand where this person came from. And I understand why this person did what they did. Not to say that it's legal, but just like Jimmy, you know, Jimmy looking at, oh, you know, Jimmy has a bright future. We wouldn't want this to stain his future.
Brock Turner.
Exactly right. Exactly right. On our rape Raper Boys episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wouldn't want this to be a blemish.
Man. So going back again to the whole jury conversation we had, in 2010, there was a national study that uncovered shocking evidence of racial discrimination in the jury selection in every southern state.
Mm-hmm.
This study, it found that there was evidence that some state and local prosecutors were actually trained to exclude people on the basis of race and instructed on how to conceal their racial bias.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like the Catholic Church. Don't it?
How?
The whole concealment thing and training.
Did the Catholic Church train people?
No, but they systematically swept child abuse and
pedophilia.
Yeah, pedophilia under the rug.
Under the rug. She's talking about the concealment thing.
Okay. I mean, with that being the case, and we did talk about how black and brown people don't show up. Not all of them, but a large number of us don't answer these jury summonses. Mm-hmm. Those of us who do get systematically excluded. And
especially when the defendant is a person of color. Like if the defendant, and once again, think about that. I don't want black people on the jury because I don't want anybody having sympathy for this black defendant.
But wouldn't the defense be able, because I remember you said you get three, right?
You get three for no cause.
Like, so you can get rid of three black people from the prosecutorial side. Okay.
But then you get rid of three white people. But the pool is how many?
Right. More white than black.
Right.
Man, So, and then in the same article, this is an article, actually, it's from The Guardian. I'll link it in the show notes. A lot of interesting things here. So, in White Lawyering, Rethinking Race, Lawyer Identity, and Rule of Law, Russell G. Pierce writes, "The latest research in the field of organizational behavior suggests that the assumption of lawyer neutrality, so central to lawyer professionalism, is not only wrong descriptively, but it also undermines white lawyers' ability to provide their black clients with optimal representation. To put it bluntly, studies show that white attorneys might have biases that result in less favorable outcomes for their black clients.
Mm-hmm.
Criminal cases aren't the only ones which black people are disadvantaged. Several studies revealed that African Americans suffer worse legal outcomes than their white counterparts in civil cases, even when controlling for income and educational levels.
Mm-hmm.
While researchers have no way of knowing whether the treatment is intentional, the proof of white attorney bias exists across many legal practice areas. A study funded by the American Bar Foundation examined employment discrimination cases and tried to determine why African Americans are 2.5 times more likely than white plaintiffs to file employment discrimination claims pro se, in which plaintiffs represent themselves and typically have significantly worse litigation outcomes than those with representation. The researchers found that while part of the problem stems from African Americans' lack of trust, information, and resources regarding lawyers and the legal system, the blame also rests on the shoulders of the mostly white discrimination lawyers who one would hope would be particularly conscious.
Conscientious, right?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Conscientious. Of the 20 lawyers who participated, 19 were white, admitted that in deciding to reject a case, they considered clients' ability to pay, as well as their perceived demeanor and mannerisms, which is often coded language for racial characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts?
If they are not saying anything that we don't already know. It's like, that's just like, and it is a truism. I'm going to push you towards settlement. And I'm going to push, like, the first thing that I see that, you know, I don't really want to fight. Because guess what? I know And this is, I'm speaking from the perspective of a white lawyer. I know you're not educated. I know you don't know what you could get. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. So the first decent offer that comes along, I'm taking it. And you're going to be happy for
more than what you got.
Right. You're going to be happy for this little not. But flip side, like they talked about the discrimination. I'm a black woman and I come to you and I say, I've been a victim of sexual misconduct on the job.
What were you wearing?
Exactly. It's like, but even though they may have shades of that with a Caucasian woman, you know, black women are more sexualized. Like, that's what everybody has in their minds. You know, she probably was in the office wearing a tight pencil skirt.
Twerking.
Right.
Man, you know, that bitch was twerking on her desk.
You know what I'm saying? So here it is. You come to them and you say, you know, I've been a victim of sexual discrimination and X, Y, and Z. And then you go, you just go through the motions.
Yeah. I can say that every attorney that I ever had was white. And I've had quite a few attorneys growing up, let's say. But yeah, all of them were white. All of them went back to the little, to the DA's office to come out with the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And man, we used to get some raw deals, but it was like, this is it. It's take it mm-hmm. or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I'm older, I know that it's not take it or leave it. It's you go take your ass back in there mm-hmm. and let's come up with something a little more acceptable. But
nah. Like I said, I know I'm not, you know, they know you're not educated. And at that point, you weren't educated enough to say, I know that it's not how it goes. I know that you can go back in and try to negotiate mm-hmm. something better than this. But, you know, you go take it. Like, here's 10 grand. Like, you know, if this is a civil case, here's 10 grand. And, you know, my eyes just got wide. Whoa, that's $10,000.
I could buy all kinds of stuff. Like my boy who... I think I told the story on a prior show, but I'll tell it again. He rented a U-Haul truck. He was moving. He had the truck parked, had the ramp down. They were unloading. The parking brake gave out on the truck, and two of his kids were behind the truck.
Mm-hmm.
So he jumps off the back of the truck and grabs the one that he was closest to. The other got ran over by the U-Haul truck.
Mm-hmm.
Got her leg. I mean, she's fine now, but at that point, it's like, what do you do? Like, from his perspective is, this truck is on top of my child because the curb stopped it on her leg.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I could jump in it and try to drive it off. That's going to rock back and forth on her leg. She's mm-hmm. screaming and hollering and crying.
Mm-hmm.
And as a parent, man, so the fire department gets out there and actually it jacks the truck up.
Mm-hmm.
Gets her out of there, gets her to the hospital. He got, his settlement was, I think it was like 25 grand. And then 5,000 per person that was there for all the other children.
Right.
Pain
right,
and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So total, he walked away with, because he got the kids money too. So I want to say probably 40 grand total. Mm-hmm. And then
mm-hmm.
that's before the lawyer took. They're 33 and a third.
If might have been 40, all depend could've on been. what he signed up for.
Could have mm-hmm. been. But I remember saying even back then, because this was, you know, years ago, and I'm like, yo, bro.
He definitely should have got more for that, no doubt.
So yeah, that's what he got. That's what he took. And same brother that had all the financial problems afterwards, but here nor there. So yeah, I'm pretty sure his attorneys was like, yeah. You know, just take it, man. Take it. It's $40,000.
Right. And I'm sure to him, it sounds like, you know, oh, you know, she all right. She doesn't have any permanent damage. There's $40,000. But see, in those type of cases, you don't know what could have happened in the future. She may have had to have further surgery.
There was psychiatric care for that matter.
There was something. I think they agreed to cover any future medical costs involved with X, Y, and Z.
As Becky just said, counseling, because something like that happens, some, you know, this trauma, not just for her, but for his other kids. You know, you just saw your sister.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point, because there were two, and he grabbed the one, and the other one got ran over. So the one that he grabbed is like, that could have been me.
Survivor's guilt or something. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I never even thought of that.
Right. So you have all of that. This was definitely a case worth more than 40 grand.
Six figures. Easy.
Easy.
So, all right. Back to this article here. In the study, Race, Attorney Influence, and Bankruptcy Chapter Choice, researchers found that even after controlling for financial, demographic, and other factors, lawyers, in part because of biases, were disproportionately steering Black people into Chapter 13, the more onerous and costly form of consumer bankruptcy.
Yep.
Attorneys recommend it to Black clients twice as often as they do to white clients, even when clients prefer the less onerous Chapter 7.
Mm-hmm.
The researchers also found that bankruptcy attorneys were more likely to recommend Chapter 13 to the hypothetical debtors named Reggie and Latisha than to Todd and Allison, all while Todd and Allison were perceived as having better values and being more competent when they wanted to file Chapter 7, giving them a fresh start. Reggie and Latisha were credited with such values only when they expressed a preference for Chapter 13. As a consequence of such biases, Black folks have the highest rate of Chapter 13 filings.
Yeah, well, you know, as a sidebar, you know, if you start out at Chapter 13, you can't go back in and refile and do a Chapter 7 bankruptcy.
But who's going to know that?
Well, they know now. FYI. So this, once again, goes back to something that we said when we spoke about the episode where we talked about biases in hiring processes. Remember how we said if your resume says Bumquisha Johnson as opposed to Alice Turner, or, you know, something other, you know, Caucasian sounding, the bias that same thing. And what we talk about overall, it's all about perception. It's all about inherent biases that Caucasian people have against people of color. Not because they know anything particular about you, but it's because of what their perception of your people are. So everybody is painted with the same brush. So you walk in, like I said, okay, they dumb. They don't know. So we go, you know, and a lot of times in cases like this about that whole Chapter 13 thing, even though it's not particularly legal to do, these trustees or whatever, you know, they're making money because you're in Chapter 13. Because for in Chapter 13, you actually have to pay. You know, it's like your debt is consolidated and you pay your a certain portion of this debt. In Chapter 7, you
clean slate.
That's it.
Wait, slate so is why would 13 be more onerous then?
Because if I am filing bankruptcy, that means I'm saying that I don't have the money to pay my creditors.
Okay, but yet you still have to pay a portion.
I am paying monthly. I have said, okay, we're going to consolidate this. I'm going to give up this. I'm going to do this. And then this is what your monthly, instead of paying $700 a month, now you're going to pay three. Are you going to pay $250? You know, you're going to pay some portion, as opposed to everything's wiped clean. You don't have to pay anything.
Right. So even the bench, does not appear exempt from such biases. In the myth of colorblind judge, Pat K. Chu, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, and Robert E. Kelly, a professor of Carnegie Mellon University Tepper School of Business, performed an empirical study of federal government harassment cases spanning 20 years. They conclude, our work initially confirmed certain characteristics of racial harassment cases. The vast majority of the judges are white. The vast majority of the plaintiff employees are African American. The vast majority of accused harassers are white, and that when studying case outcomes, plaintiff employees have very poor win rate in general, succeeding in only 22% of cases overall. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, the statistical analysis consistently showed that the race of the judge can make a significant difference. While plaintiffs have a poor win rate in general, they are much more likely to win if their cases come before an African-American judge rather than white judges. Mm-hmm. The lack of judicial diversity extends beyond federal courts to state benches, where majority of legal disputes are adjudicated. Look, I knew that big word. A report by the Brennan Center found that judicial selection commissions of some states have no African-American representation. And as recently as 2010, there were still some states with all white benches. Mm-hmm. They also noted evidence that the number of black male judges is actually decreasing. Mm-hmm. According to the ABA, American Bar Association, in state trial courts where the vast majority of cases are handled, only 7% of judges are black. So we basically got 4.8% of black attorneys. We have 7% black of black judges. Damn, bro, we ain't doing well.
We are woefully underrepresented in most professional jobs.
Yeah.
And it's true.
I'd agree with that. I mean, Becky, we'll get into your field in a second. And how would you or would you encourage black youth to pursue a career as a legal professional?
Hell yeah. I mean, you know, the reason why I got into law is because I saw a need for more black lawyers. That's number one. And I say I saw that from a personal window because, yeah, a lot of people in my family, real criminal-like. So I saw from the courtroom, you know, you step into a courtroom trying to support a family member and you look around and, like, the lawyer your family member has is white, the prosecutor is white, the judge is white, most of the jury is white.
The deputies.
Right. And it's like, well, damn. And I was like, all right. So my thought was, and really this was my thought process, it's like, what better way to know how to game the system than from inside of the system?
That's what I'd be saying about women. What better way to game the women?
Except from inside
the women. Being inside the women.
Being inside the women, yeah. But that was that was my thought. You know, in order to know how to beat the system, you have to know the system. In order to know the system, you have to be in the middle, you know, be in the middle of the system. Talk to the people who are in the system. Get to know it. That's the only way.
Maybe we should try to be more like Indian and Asian cultures. If you ain't a doctor or a lawyer, you ain't nothing.
You ain't nothing. See,
I literally just had this conversation with Paul yesterday in preparation for our upcoming show, right? We know a child soldier from Sierra Leone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Came over here when he was real young. He is now a major in the Air Force. He went to college for something or another, got out and said, I want to be an officer in the Air Force. Just walked in, and they take very few walk-ins, like walking in off the street. So anyway, he's a major now. And we were talking about how, you know, there's a stereotype that Asians are hard on their kids. That's all they do is study. You know, they mm-hmm. force them to get A's. But nah, it's when people come from poorer countries such as Sierra Leone, they see nothing but opportunity here.
Mm-hmm.
We take mm-hmm. these opportunities for granted.
Yes.
We take education for granted. Right. We take everything for granted because right. we've been here for 400 plus years. Right. So this is like everyday shit to us. Like, for instance, I lived in D.C., right? The monuments, the Smithsonian's, all this historical shit. You know how many times I've been to that stuff?
Mm-hmm.
It's like once or twice, maybe.
Right. And
took it for granted. It's right down the street. Right.
And it's free.
That's why, because home of the free, land of the brave. So honestly, And for the most part, brothers and sisters, please do not blow me up on Twitter. I know
you don't check that shit. No way.
I do. I do. When I say this, I say this out of love. And I know that it is a generalization, but the reason why we have generalizations is because somebody is saying something over and over again. The United States does not owe us anything.
Bullshit. 40 acres and a mule.
No, no, and no.
Shit, they no. owe us we that
are,
shit.
We are not entitled. And that is honestly the mindset of a lot of our people. We are entitled to this. They owe it to us. The white man did it.
But that's all true.
No.
The white man did do it.
But the thing is, the world owe us nothing. It owes us nothing. We have
us,
the same.
Us as individuals, the, no. But our culture and our community, yes, they do owe us.
We have the same opportunity. Let me tell you something. Even though we came over here unwilling and we were put into slavery, Asian people came here as indentured servants.
Right.
And they looked around, and as you said, they saw opportunity. They didn't see, oh, they owe me. Japanese.
You're making a bad parallel.
No,
here.
I'm saying that things happen to a lot of people in the United States who were not Caucasians.
Yeah.
You know, Japanese people were put in internment camps.
Right.
You know, people, things happen. And it's not like they are riding on the coattails. Hell, Jews in Paris. Jews in Germany.
Niggas in Paris.
You stupid. They're not in Germany going, y'all owe us for the Holocaust.
Well, here's my thing.
You know what I'm saying?
The equivalency is, I see what you're saying, but the Japanese, and we're talking about America here. The Japanese, the Chinese, even the Hispanics, they did not have hundreds of years of
enslavement,
enslavement, of legislation. Like, we were three-fifths of a man. They don't say nothing about Chinese people being three-fifths of none. And I'm serious. Like, sure, they had setbacks, but our setbacks were not only setbacks. They kicked us when we were down.
True, but we had a black president. True.
That don't fix shit.
I know it doesn't fix it, but what I'm saying is, you can move from poverty to the most powerful person in the world.
You can.
You can do that.
You can also move from poverty to a prison cell.
You can. And although the system is set up to kick us and keep us in a certain position, you can move beyond that. The thing is, you have to change your mindset. Nobody owes you anything. I don't care what the hell they do to you. They owe you nothing. Make your way. And it might be difficult, true, but make your way. Stop sitting around and saying, and we see this every day in the jobs that we do. You know, oh, the government, oh, that's my money. The government owe me.
You know, I find it ironic coming from an attorney saying nobody owes you anything.
They owe me shit if I work for them, yes.
Nah, man. I'm going to say that I do believe that the world as a whole owes black people. And here's how that debt can be paid or should have been paid. One, stop pillaging our fucking continent. Seriously.
Stop pillaging our continent. We gave it to them.
We didn't willingly give it to
them.
Yeah,
we did.
No,
because, you know, let me tell you something. Black people sold other black people.
Yes.
We enslaved them and gave them
to people. We didn't give Africa to them. They are still pillaging Africa, the blood diamonds. You look at South Africa. You look at Nelson Mandela.
South Africa.
There's apartheid. There you go.
Uh-huh.
Like that.
White people did in Africa basically what white people did in America.
What white people are doing now. They gentrified Africa, basically. And, you know, it's like you've already taken so much from us. We're already centuries behind the rest of you all.
But you know what?
But you continue to do to us.
But with that kind of mindset, we'll never get ahead. Because guess what? even though we
hold on, with the kind of mindset to ask someone to remove themselves from my community.
No, even though we started behind, we have made strides that a lot of people of color have not. I mean, we are inventors, even though they try to take that from us. We've invented processes and things that American couldn't live without. I mean, the freaking stoplight. That's us.
Yeah, because people wouldn't have known when to stop.
But but I'm saying, yes. And now the new Jim Crow and the new apartheid is called gentrification, because now we are trying, instead of trying to get us to assimilate, they're moving into historically black areas and claiming it for their own, but do something about it. Support black businesses.
Well,
support black lawyers. Support black doctors. And you said something about that earlier. Mm-hmm. We know people who are black, but who will not support black businesses.
I am one of them.
And black lawyers. I'm and black doctors and black accountants.
Well, not all that, but I'm one of them when it comes to, like I was telling the homie CJ. He had a segment last week or the week before about black businesses, right? And he asked, who supports black businesses? I said, I don't. And it's not that I willingly do not go to black businesses.
Yes,
I just don't seek them out. I don't say, hey, I need, a pair of shoes. Let me find a black business to go buy these shoes. Or, hey, I need this. Let me go find a black business. Nah. I'm just going to wherever I typically go to get these things. I'm not going out of my way to go to a black business, because the few times I have gone to black businesses, the customer service was shitty. The prices were ridiculous compared to other, even national chains that carry the same product. So one, if I walk in to a black business and I'm greeted with, yeah, what up, nigga? Wrong with you, motherfucker? You supposed to be a professional, goddammit.
All I know is we get shitty service at white owned business all the time, and that's we go back.
Well, let me say it. Places I get shitty service from, period, I do not go back to. But at least with a place like, I don't know, a drugstore, say Walgreens, right?
Oh, you have a corporate office
exactly
that you can call and say they gave me shitty service at the Walgreens.
They discriminated against me. And then they have these insurances that we just learned about. So, I'm saying, I don't go out of my way to support black businesses. No.
And that's wrong.
It's not wrong.
That's wrong.
My shopping habits are my shopping habits. They're not right. So, they're right for me.
So why not?
I don't. Evolve? Wait. You just said don't nobody owe you nothing. So
why not evolve and change your shopping hat?
Okay, here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. You know, we were tossing around the idea of a live podcast, right? So I said, hey, there's this place right by St. Claude. It's called the Wine Cellar or something like that, the mm-hmm, wine place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's owned by a black man.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke with the owner in depth and seemed like a nice guy, older guy. So I called Ann. As soon as I finished talking, I said, yo, I got a place for a live podcast. It's this wine show. People can come in, sip. We got parking. It'll be dope. Hell no, I ain't spending no money with them niggas. They charge too much. Everything expensive up in there. Hell, he done lost his damn mind charging what he charged. And I'm like,
now you know what?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, America and beyond. Does that even sound like me?
Did you not say that place was too expensive to go to?
I said for what it was and what he charged, because I actually went in there. I used to frequent that place every week because they had Wine Down Wednesdays.
Alcoholic.
I'm not an alcoholic. I am not an alcoholic. They had Wine Down Wednesdays. They also had situations where you can go and view Olivia Pope.
Who?
Scandal. You know, they had Scandal viewing parties. So I would go, you know, get a glass of wine, get some crudité, you know, get some charcuterie.
They didn't have popcorn?
They did. You could buy like cheeses. You could buy, as I said, charcuterie. You could buy some crude. I mean, I supported this business. And then wanted.
And then I said, let's do a live show there.
And then I wanted to have an event because it was a cool little spot. It was like, okay, let's go see how much they would charge. And so I contacted them and several other places that had the same
ambiance.
Had the same ambiance, had actually had the same sort of meeting area, you know, just to see. Like, he was charging two times what the highest person charged. And I was like, wait a minute.
Okay, but yet I need to expand my shopping horizons.
Guess what? I still supported them. I still went to the Wine Down Wednesdays. I still bought
wine. Because you were supporting alcoholic, your head.
You know, exactly. I still bought wine from the place.
You exactly. ain't supporting them. You know, support
I'm supporting
head.
Them. No, because I can buy wine anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I can go Wine Down Wednesday anywhere.
Man. But anyway, going back to the original point is the conversation I was having with Paul is, of course, these people from these war-torn and third-world countries, they see nothing but opportunity over here. Mm-hmm. And we've been here for forever, and we're just like, eh. And it's sad that education is not a big thing in our community. Nope. Like, striving for...
And we, you know what? To break in, we've said it before, and I mentioned earlier entitlement. And the system is set up to keep us on government-funded programs.
And to keep the fathers out of the household.
It's true. And it is just another way that we are, it's another form of oppression. But our people, they don't see that. Because you try to tell them, get off of this program and get a job. What I'm going to do that for when I make more money not working than I do if I would go and find a job.
That's actually true in a lot of cases, too. Right. And that's sad. So let me ask you this. Have you taken any steps personally to try to bridge the gap between our community and law school?
Actually, I have. I am a part of a mentor program that the Louisiana State Bar Association and the New Orleans Bar sponsors. There's also a Lawyers in the Classroom thing program that is sponsored by, I think it's called the Louisiana Committee for Civil Education, I believe the name of but it's called Lawyers in the Classroom. And what they do is pretty much what it sounds like. They put lawyers in the classroom.
And be like, little Billy, that's 5 to 10.
And you know, well, you talk about things like the Constitution. You inform the children about the law and how the law affects them. And that's basically, you're in there to give them an idea of how laws affect them. And also to show them, guess what? This too can be you. You know, you can be the next lawyer. You can be the next judge.
Giving them real life examples of a person.
Well, let me jump in. As a child, I don't like what age range are we talking here?
There's actually programs for all age ranges from kindergarten. Well, not so much kindergarten, but there is like an elementary. It's elementary, middle school, and high school.
See, I can't see getting and this is actually going to take us into the next question too. I can't see getting elementary school children with no exposure in their home life, I guess, to the law, excited about the law. And let's be real, to kind of get children interested in anything, there has to be a certain level of excitement.
Right. Well, you know what?
You're talking about the Constitution. I'm be like, man, get your ass out of here.
I gave the Constitution as an example. That's not the only thing you talked about. You can actually, you know, talk about how the law works. You know, children see cops. So you talk about how police officers uphold the law. And you talk about, you know, sad but true, even in elementary school, children in our communities, they have had a majority, well, an abundance. I'm not going to say a majority. An abundance of them have had not conflicts, but police have touched their lives. You know, some, in some way, shape, or form, the law and the courts have touched their lives. I mean, as a matter of fact, someone that we know, 7-year-old granddaughter, the law has touched her life more than once. You know, she's been in court more than once.
Well, I guess my question to piggyback off Dan is how do you turn that into a positive experience? Because as a child, if the law is involved in your life,
you're afraid.
It's a negative experience. Right.
It's about fear. So just like, you remember Officer Friendly in school?
You said that about 10 episodes and we tell your ass no every time.
Wait, y'all don't remember? You don't remember?
We did not have no officer. We had Officer, I'll fuck your ass up, nigga.
Well, you know, it was basically the way to get children not to be afraid of the police. It was a way to say, hey, police are your friends. So that's the lawyers in the classroom. They also have a judges in the classroom program. It's to get you to see that lawyers are not bad people. Lawyers help. So just like...
they help, but it costs a lot of money.
Just for like, the right price, they'll help you.
They help.
They're like prostitutes.
But you know what? Really?
For the right price, sliding scale.
You know what? Lawyers are gigolos. Man. And prostitutes. Yeah. We do anything for money. Nah.
Lastly, though, does being a black attorney hurt you or your clients, like personally?
We talked about it, and like I said, I've been on that spectrum, and I've seen that if you're not buddy, even though you know that you have a great case and you've done all the research and you make in your head, in your client's head, what you think is the best argument, and then you have a lawyer on the other side who knows the judge and knows, you know, has been in the judge's courtroom, and maybe they went to a CLE together and you saw him when he spoke at this. So y'all have this relationship. As with anything, you're more lenient towards somebody that you know and you identify with. And that's true. That's Man. Real.
So I hate to cut the conversation short, but gotta run. So we're going to pick back up on this particular topic next week as far as black professionals in general. Once again, you can find the show on all platforms at Black Law Podcast. I am your host with the most, Dan. You can find me on Twitter and IG at I am Dan on Drugs.
I enjoyed co-hosting tonight. This is Afro Becky.
Hi, and this is Just Ann. And I'd like to rebut that host with the most. The most what? The most dumbness? The most what?
I got the most everything.
And lies. Oh, yeah. Follow me at I Tell Legal Lies on Twitter.
Peace.